This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good evening, everybody. Tonight we're taking upright speech, and so you've all been studying the Buddha's teaching on right speech, so he spoke of it in terms of four very particular ways in which we don't speak rightly, speaking falsehoods, speaking slanderously, speaking harshly, and speaking idly. And I wanted to start by reading something from the Lankavatara Sutra, which is a sutra associated with the Yogacara school, which is really going deeply into the Buddhist understanding of consciousness and how we perceive and how karmic actions, in a sense, take up residence within our consciousness, and how that binds us, but then at the same time how that can be liberating. And so here in the sutra, one of the Buddha's disciples asks, why should... Let's see. He says the Blessed One said that we should not grasp meaning according to words. But why shouldn't we grasp meaning from words? What are words and what is meaning? And the Buddha said, how is speech produced? Depending on discrimination and habit energy. As the cause, there's a conjunction and the distinction of sounds and letters, which issuing from the teeth and jaws and palate, tongue, lips, and the cavity of the mouth, make mutual conversations possible. This is speech. Now, what is meaning? The bodhisattva, the practitioner, is said to have grasped meaning when all alone in a lonely place, they walk the path to nirvana, leading to nirvana. By means of their transcendental wisdom, which grows from encountering the Dharma, reflecting and meditating, and causing a revolution, first at the source of their habit energy, by their self-knowledge, their insight, they abide on the stages of self-realization where they lead a life full of excellent deeds. He says, further, the bodhisattva who is conversant with words, and so meaning here, we normally think of meaning as the meaning of words and language. And he's using, this is Suzuki, has translated, I'm not sure what the word is that he's using for meaning. Reality. So he's translating a word that alternately means reality, which is much better. So he's not really meaning it here in a conceptual sense. That meaning is to realize directly the nature of things. And so he says, the bodhisattva who understands with words and meaning observes that words are neither different nor not different from meaning, from reality, and that reality stands in the same relationship to words. If reality is different from words, then it won't be made manifest by means of words. And we're, in other words, language couldn't point to or bring forth reality. But reality is entered into by words as things are revealed by a lamp, sutras, the teachings. It is like a person carrying a lamp to look after their property. By means of the light, they can say, this is my property, and so keep it in place, in order. Just so, by means of the lamp of words and speech originating from discrimination, the bodhisattva can enter into the exalted state of self-realization, which is free from speech and discrimination. If a person becomes attached to the literal meaning of words and holds fast to their agreement in regard to the original state of nirvana, which is unborn and undying, they will come to cherish views, either affirmatively or negatively. In other words, if we attach to the concepts behind words, then we will come to have views and cherish those views, and in terms of grasping and rejecting. As all kinds of objects are seen in this world and are discriminated, statements also are erroneously made, and discriminations erroneously go on. It is by the deluded that discriminations thus go on. It is different with the wise, with the realized. And so there's this deep understanding of the relationship and the sort of the function of language within our consciousness. You know, we know that language comes from our mind, but what does that mean? How do we understand it? And what is the role, if all things are dependent, if all conditioned things are dependent, that is, nothing exists on its own, then what are the conditions, causes and conditions that are necessary for speech, which is our subject tonight, to come forth? And what are those causes and conditions that leads to false speech or divisive, slanderous, idle speech? And what are those causes and conditions that lead to right speech? And that speech, we know, is karma and creates consequence. Like anyone can see that. But what's harder to see is that the speech, that our language is both conditioned by those causes and conditions, by our mind, by our culture, by all of our experiences, by our emotions, by our views. And at the same time, they are conditioning. So they're both a result of consciousness, and they're also creating our consciousness. They arise from the sense of self, but they're also creating a sense of self. They arise from a certain view of the world, of self and other, but they're also creating a sense of self in the world at the same time. And so, you know, to really think about how much emphasis there is in Buddhism and the teachings on speech and language. And in Zen, there's a lot of emphasis on how we misconstrue it and we misunderstand the language that points to something for the thing itself. And so one of the analogies that's used in the Yogacara literature is that when you look up the meaning of a word, what you encounter are just more words that have their own meaning. And sometimes you have to look up the meaning of those words, right? And it's sort of like an infinite path, right, into these various streams of meaning that at the same time, in a sense, are taking you further and further away from the reality of the thing that the original word was pointing to. So what I thought we'd do is just look at each of these four aspects of speech, how we can use speech, and how the Buddha sort of distinguished or brought out these four particular modes of speech as being particularly important, potent, powerful in terms of the karma that they can create the negative karma, but also then how we can use that same speech differently. And so in the precepts, we have not speaking of others' errors and faults, not elevating self and blaming others, not speaking falsely, not lying. And we can also look at the 10th great precept, not defiling the three treasures, is also another mode of speech in which we use speech to basically try and injure or destroy, defile the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so speech is considered particularly important because it's like a window into our mind, into our understanding, right? So when we speak, we consciously or otherwise, even if we're trying to control our speech so we're only presenting what we want to present, that itself is a window. And so it's very powerful as a way of both seeing, studying the self, and other. And so the first is to speak falsely, false speak, or alternately to speak truthfully. And so the Buddha said, someone someone avoids false speech and abstains from it. They speak the truth, are devoted to truth, are reliable, worthy of confidence, and they are not a deceiver of people. Being at a meeting or amongst people or in the midst of relatives or in a society or in the court or in a sangha, and being called upon and asked as witness to tell what they know, they answer, if they know nothing, I don't know. And if they know, they answer, I know something. If they have seen nothing, then they say, I have seen nothing. And if they have seen something, they say, I have seen something. Thus, they never knowingly speak a lie, either for the sake of their own advantage or the sake of another person's advantage or for the sake of any advantage whatsoever. They speak truthfully. And so so teachings say that with greed as a basis, then we can speak falsely to achieve some gain. We want something, and so we speak falsely. With anger or ill will as a basis, we can use false speech to hurt and injure. And with delusion as a basis, we can just speak irrationally or compulsively lie or exaggerate or use falsehoods to try and ingratiate ourselves. And so in that, all of these ways, speech just becomes a vehicle. And what the Buddha is saying is the purpose of speech is to align oneself with what is true. And Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about how, he says, it's said that in the course of a bodhisattva, or the Buddha's long training for enlightenment over many lives, that in all of those lives, one can break all the moral precepts except the commitment to speaking truthfully. It's rather interesting. He says the reason for this is very profound and reveals the commitment to truth has a significance transcending the domain of ethics and even mental purification. So it's interesting. He's saying that the path of commitment to truth goes beyond just right and wrong, what is ethically right, and even beyond purifying the mind, taking us to the domains of knowledge in our very being. Truthful speech provides, within the sphere of interpersonal communication, a parallel to wisdom in the sphere of private understanding. So, in a sense, our speech going outward towards each other is to manifest truth in the sphere of relationship. And that's a parallel to how wisdom, realized wisdom, is sort of doing the same thing, aligning ourselves or realizing wisdom and what is true within. He says the two are respectively the outward and inward modalities of the same commitment to what is real. Wisdom consists in the realization of truth, what is real. And here, truth, you know, is a little bit of a tricky word because it's used in so many different ways, the truth, right? As though there is some, idea, some concept, some knowable thing that is the truth. And here, truth really is meaning what is real. It's fundamentally what is real. So wisdom consists in the realization of reality, and reality is not just a verbal proposition, but is the nature of things as they are. To realize truth, our whole being has to be brought into accord with that very reality, with things as they are, which requires that in communication with others, we respect things as they are by speaking the truth. And so this is another way of thinking about what is practice? What are we doing in practice? As we work with our minds, as we let go, as we learn how to skillfully practice things that obstruct us, things that are binding, things that are destructive, in thought, speech, and action, bringing forth intentions, that really what we're doing is, he says, to realize reality, our whole being has to become reality itself. Right? It has to come into accord with things as they are. And in a sense, that's the moment of realization, is when the whole of one's being is in alignment, is perfectly in accord with reality, and there's a realization of that, a cognition, in a sense, of that. He says, truthful speech establishes a correspondence between our own inner being and the real nature of phenomena. So language is sort of our language that establishes this correspondence, this relationship between inner and outer. In a sense, when we read a sutra, it's like establishing a relationship with what is true, like an enlightened mind, the mind of the Buddha or the mind of a sutra, with our own mind, our deluded mind, which allows wisdom to rise up so that we can fathom our real nature. Thus, much more than an ethical principle, devotion to truthful speech is a matter of taking our stand on reality rather than illusion, on the reality of things as they are, grasped by wisdom rather than the fantasies woven by desire. So that really presents, speaking truthfully in a very, very deep and profound way. And then, of course, just in an ordinary sense, maybe that's what we should get to, but just by seeing what thoughts and questions and comments you have. So this is a little bit about what the teachings are saying, what the Buddha said, but how do you understand this, and what are your thoughts about speaking falsely and speaking truthfully?
You mentioned being in harmony and speaking in harmony with what comes before you. And the contrast to that is what's going on with all the trolls.
Is what?
With all the trolls, and the the internet stuff is like in the massive amount of lies, and I cannot wrap my head around it, because to speak and be in harmony is, it's very quiet, and to do that is creating this chaos that I can't understand and utterly disturbs me.
Yeah, and but delusion is just a different kind of alignment, you could say. Delusion is aligning ourselves with delusion.
But it fractures.
Yeah, but in that relative alignment, there is some sense of, I wouldn't say peace, but some kind of, some sense of being in accord with something, right? So even when we're why else would we attach and maintain and sustain our deluded views? They bring us into alignment with some sense mentally, physically, emotionally, psychologically, with some sense of being in accord with something. I mean, in other words, it's giving us some kind of satisfaction.
I'm not there.
I mean, that's why it's so hard to shake, because we take that, you know, relative satisfaction, you know, which becomes more and more specious and fractured, the more distant it is from what is true, right? But, you know, we have this capacity to just keep, you know, I remember one time talking to a student who was in recovery and was just talking about addiction. This was actually at a retreat, so he was speaking publicly. And he said that one of the things about being in an addictive state is that if you think of my morality as my horizon, right? This is the horizon within which I am functioning, right? This is my moral sphere. That within addiction, that horizon just keeps shifting. It just keeps moving, right? As necessitated by my addiction. So as my addiction requires that I act in less and less moral ways to maintain the addiction, I have to keep moving that horizon back, right? So that I can maintain a sense of some sense of integrity or wholeness or, you know, some sense of okayness, even though it's, you know, it's being...
The question that's coming up for me is, and I think there's a story in one of the sutras, or maybe it's the Jataka Tales, of a hunter going after a prey and asking, like, did you see which way the animal went? Mm-hmm. And saying, the other way, mm-hmm. went the other way. You know, not so like lying for protection.
Right.
And that seems particularly relevant now in our political situation where the supposed protection of our systems
right.
is not protective.
Right.
And, so, can you speak to that?
Right. So, looking at this from the perspective of the precepts, that there is the direct understanding, which is as much as possible, whenever possible, at all times, just speak truthfully. But when to do so would actually cause harm and wouldn't bring about any particular benefit. Then, out of compassion and reverence for life, sometimes the way to actually speak truthfully is to speak falsely. Truthfully in the sense of being more in accord with what is true, what is real, which might mean someone else's well-being or welfare. Right? But, I mean, the thing about these four forms of speech, of course, we all know them. You know, we've all had experience speaking in these various ways. And so it's something we can all relate to. And remember the importance in we're in the moral aspect of the Eightfold Path, right? Speech, action, and livelihood. And that within these realm, intention becomes extremely important. And so that's where, you know, practicing the precepts in that way, you know, where we're actually saying something that isn't truthful, because our sense is that that's the way to actually serve, that our intention to really be clear that that's what we're doing, right? Because it's very easy to use that to just let ourselves off the hook or avoid a difficult conversation, or, and we've all done that too, I'm presuming.
When on Sunday, when you, not this last Sunday, but when you first announced the first academic, this group was going to be Right Thinking, I was like, oh, the whole sangha will be there for that one. That's the easy one. Right Speech is the one that, like, that's the hard one. And then reading about Right Speech, how it connected Right Thinking to Right Speech.
Right Thought, you mean?
Right Thought.
Yeah.
And they also talked about loving kindness, mm-hmm. The metta practices within Right Thought. And I've experienced some relief in Right Thought through that, and I feel like my actions have been beneficial. That's helped me do good. Mm-hmm. But the speech for me has been opening to a fear that I always have, but I can't always see it. But I feel alone. I feel scared. Mm-hmm. And then when I speak, it just comes out. And so...
You mean feeling fearful? What comes out? The fear or...
Well, I don't feel fearful until I speak. Uh-huh. So it's a window, I think, to uh-huh. A fear that's there.
Yeah. Yeah, so in that sense, you could look at speaking truthfully as in speaking, seeing the truth, you know, of how that reflects your own mind. And it was just allowing yourself to see that honestly, you know, to be studying the self in our speaking, right? And see how that is reflecting back where what's going on. And in that way, then, speech also becomes a powerful tool to work with that, right? Because, again, it's not only arising from our consciousness, but it's shaping our consciousness, right? So if we have never, you know, if we've been sort of conditioned to not speak, right, to be silent, so then to shift that karma by giving ourselves voice, by reclaiming our voice, you know, is, and sometimes the content even isn't even so much as important, that's a way of using that same instrument, right, to turn that, which could be understood as coming more into alignment with who we actually are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you somewhat answered the question with that last response. But I was curious how your relationship to speech changed as you deepened your practice.
It seems like I do a lot more of it. I think taking it a lot more seriously. And, you know, the other side of this is, or the maybe just part of the inevitable part of the process, is that we can go from being not very aware to being hyper aware, you know, not very conscious to being, you know, overly self-conscious. And that's just sort of part of the, you know, finding our facility. But I think recognizing both how more and more how powerful it is, and also being more sensitive and attuned to the inner state of within myself when I am speaking both more in alignment and when I'm not. You know, and I think that's a really important part of practice. It's why practice needs to be and is such an embodied experience, because we're constantly giving ourselves basically messages about when we're moving towards what's true and when we're moving away from it. And you know, most of us, our history is trying not to be too sensitive to that, right? Particularly if we're invested in something that isn't really of helping us, then we want to sort of screen those messages, right? Because they're trying to get our attention and get us to move in a different way. But with practice, if we're practicing sincerely, that's got to change. And we need to become much more attentive and attuned to see how responsive our inner state is to our various modes and our various ways of bringing ourselves forth, which is tremendously important and powerful, because it gives us much more, you know, in a sense, feedback, if you will. Yeah, Alec.
The thing about you know, speaking truth and being in alignment with reality, there's some difficulty for me with this, because it just seems like our ability to do that is limited. is always limited.
To do what?
To see the truth, to see the true nature of what's before us. And yet, you know, in some of the writings, it's really you have the presentation that it makes it seem like some large opening appears, and you know, the true reality of the world sort of, you know, shines forth, and maybe it's just difficult for me. I mean, you know, I can think of so many times when I was trying to be true, you know, and yet I didn't fully understand.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
what was fully going on, or what somebody was, you know, whatever. You know, there's so many things, and I can't envision that. I mean, I can envision being less, that my approach being less wrapped up with these, you know, notions of how I want to appear, or how I want to, you know, present, or what, you know, or what I'm trying, what image I'm trying to fulfill, what, at the same time I'm trying to, whatever, you know.
So just imagine.
I can't see getting any smarter.
But just, well, it's not so much a matter of being smarter, but just imagine that process continuing.
Yeah.
And that process has no limit, is boundless. You know, that's Dogen said, the limit of our ability to see, or our ability to see is limited by the extent of our vision.
Right.
I mean, it's as simple and as profound as that. Yeah. And so, so that's true. Right? So in that sense, you know, so Wendell Berry said, so if we understand that, he was talking more in terms of just, you know, understanding the world conceptually. So if we recognize that in a person's life and throughout history, we're always learning more. That's just another way of saying that we're always discovering things we didn't know before, which means we're always functioning with a certain amount of ignorance. So he said, so how should we conduct ourselves knowing that? And his answer was with humility. Right? We should always know that there's something that we're not yet, we're functioning with a certain amount of delusion, a certain amount of ignorance, both in a relative sense and in a, you know, in a more ultimate sense, you know, until we are the next Buddha. And I think that's just very simple and true advice, you know, that we should, knowing that, right, then that helps us. Right? To rather than think of that as some deficiency that you have, it's a universal experience, and knowing that actually brings you closer to the truth, rather than when you think that's not true, you know, and then you act with hubris or, you know, without awareness. I think it's also, you know, this is all of these, you know, I can't help in preparing for this and thinking about this, of just thinking about, you know, the state of our time and how these forms of wrong speech are on such florid display, right? At the highest levels, you know, people with the most of responsibility, the people who are supposed to be acting most responsibly and who are supposed to be held to the highest standards, right, of just basic decency, as well as moral standards. And what happens when that's not true, and when that becomes, common. And how, you know, it's not just that it's so, from a Buddhist perspective, it's extremely dangerous, right? It puts us in grave danger, not just because of political consequences, but because of the moral state, the spiritual state that it puts, not just these people, but all of us in, right? Because these, I mean, that's part of what power is the power to, in a sense, enter into other people's consciousness, right? Be part of other people's, intrude ourselves into other people's minds and affect them. And so, you know, that to me is one of the most distressing things, is to see the just seemingly abandonment with which these, what are clearly lies, right? Sort of unvarnished, unhidden. So, you know, and that's also why, you know, the old saying, you know, don't shoot the messenger. You know, the truth tellers generally get hurt. Because truth tellers are telling truth to power. They're not just speaking in a void.
Kind of leaves the person to themselves. Mm-hmm. Like, if you're lying, or if there's more control, like a kind of control, like you were saying.
In line?
Yeah.
Well, it's trying to control.
But when it's truthful, then actually the person's left alone.
The person
like the
speaking?
The truth teller is, it doesn't go into them in that way. It's their own that's meeting. Mm.
Because they're not trying to control.
Do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is another way of speaking of alignment, is just another way of speaking of harmony. Yeah. So it's just being, it's not opposing. Yeah. Yeah. Did you, Robbie?
I was going to say that I find one of the reasons right speech is so challenging, or challenging in its own right, in comparison to, say, right thought, is that it's like very much a dance or an exchange. You know, you can do right thought, and it's all, you know, internal, and there's not too much like expectation mm-hmm. around you of how mm-hmm. you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like it can be easier to change that right, like that thought pattern.
Mm-hmm.
But then when somebody comes to you with sort of, you know, they speak in a certain way, or of like, you know, you see the expectation within what they say, you know, it just brings out that habitual.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's true. And I think the degree to which we're sort of bound, you know, within those patterns and maybe not yet confident to stand on our own ground. But in another sense, thoughts are much harder to control, you know, or to, and not in a aggressive way, but just in a kind of skillful way. Whereas speech, you know, it's because we're choosing our words, if we're relatively aware, and so we can choose how to speak, when to speak, how much to say, how to frame something. So we actually have quite a bit more control with our speech. And that's one of the reasons it's such a powerful form of practice, because we can really work with that in a way that we have a little bit more, you know, access to. And in that way, it works its way back into our consciousness, right? Because in that speaking, we're both bringing forth certain intention, and in that very effort, right, something is changing, and also we're hearing ourselves. You know, that's one of the important things that I think about chanting. You know, chanting a sutra is you're hearing your own voice speak the Dharma, right? And that's why I also think it's important to do liturgy on your own, right? So that you hear your own voice alone, naked, right, speaking that truth. And that's very powerful. You know, I mean, to think about how speaking falsely, how much we rely on that, right? I mean, think about just our lives here, you know, and within the falsehoods, you know, that pass back and forth between us, because we're still on the path and practicing, and yet that the basic, you know, ground is that we have faith that we are going to, you know, strive to be truthful to each other. And that allows us to relax, right? To, within that trust, to not be on our guard, because when we don't trust another person's truthfulness, then we have to be on our guard, right? Because we don't know what to believe. We don't know it. And so it's essential for any kind of relatedness that is cohesive, that is moving towards cohesion. And to the degree that that's not happening, that breaks down a little. And, you know, it's repairable. That's why I was struck by that comment of Bhikkhu Bodhi, how it's sort of, you can do everything else but lie. It's like, holy cow. It means we're all out of luck. But, he made his point in terms of its much deeper understanding. And that from the point of view of Buddhism and karma, that in speaking falsely, that is karma, and the consequence of that is twofold. One is that it reinforces speaking falsely within ourselves, so it makes it easier to do it again. And it also becomes, we lose control of that falsehood once we let go of it, right? So, because once we've spoken it, we don't know where that's going. And so, and in that way, it can become larger than we expected. We didn't expect it to turn into this, but there it goes. And then that becomes part of what we have to deal with. Who's got the mic?
When I'm chanting Dharanis, either in service or by myself, I have a different experience of language and meaning. And I'm wondering, what kind of speech is that? And that's always been kind of a tantalizing way of engaging with language, because there are words, and it happens when I'm speaking of language that I don't really understand, or in an environment with language, it's like on the kind of cusp of comprehension. And then when I speak my own language and my own words, I lose it immediately. So I'm wondering, what is that? And how does that relate to right speech?
Well, I mean, some of the Dharanis, you know, are translatable. And so if we understand the meaning, then that becomes part of your chanting. If we don't, then you're really just relying upon the sounds, but also the intent of that Dharani. And so when we chant the Shosamyo and it is, you know, we understand it to be a healing Dharani, then that sense is within us as we chant. So without, in the same way that when you chant the Amejuku, it's one of the nice things I think about chanting it translated and not, is it translated, you're engaging the direct meaning. When we're chanting it on Sunday and it's not translated, you know, there's the sense of this sutra of great compassion, which is still within us. And so, so I guess on a certain level that it's still functioning as language, but it's a little different. I hadn't really thought about that. You know, it's different from a mantra. Mantra is just sound. And, you know, mantra means to protect the mind. So that's more to hold the mind within a state of concentration. At the same time that it's bringing one in contact with a kind of a primordial sound. Okay, maybe a couple more.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about what you were saying about intention and karma, you know, in relation to right speech. And I was thinking of a friend of mine. I have actually a few friends who do this, but they're like chronic storytellers. And I think they've been telling stories so long, you know, like since they were children, I think. And they don't realize that they do it. And so I was just wondering.
You mean speech, saying something that they're presenting as truth, but they're just...
Yeah, I mean, it's just like telling stories about something that they did when they went down to the city or, you know.
Is it made up, though? Or do you mean it in the sense of lie?
Yeah. Well, it's not like, I guess you wouldn't really call it a lie, but it's not a true story. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well,
I do know. There are some times when I do know. Yeah. Because of other circumstances.
Yeah, but it's hard to resist.
I mean,
what's
the karma of that? I mean, and you know, I
mean,
noticed
you've got the gist of a good story, but you know you can make it better. You know? I mean, if you're going to tell a story,
Well, that's true. But when it becomes chronic, you know,
and you know, from this perspective, you know, teachers talk about exaggeration as. Because then it, you know, in a sense it becomes a slippery slope. You could also look at it in terms of what is the intention. You know, is it, you know, maligning people? Is it sort of, you know, hurting? Or is it just, you know,
you know, the thing that I feel sometimes with when I'm talking to some of these people, and I know that there's a story that's being made up, I think it stems from low self-esteem, and you know, it's sort of painful to watch that. I don't know.
Okay, why don't you give the mic to Shalyn, because she's been raising her hand. I'm sorry.
Oh, thank you. Well, I was thinking about how speech is, you know, the creative, our creation of our world and the creative power of our mind, and that speech then becomes this very, like, active, creative force, actually. Mm. And you guys were talking about liturgy, like, that's certainly a really explicit way that we're bringing forward that, like, creative potential. And then I was thinking about, like, listening, you know, and, like, receiving, the kind of the receiving piece of that. And so, like, you know, there isn't really a right listening.
Well, not spoken, but, you know, the purpose of speaking is to be heard.
Do you think that that's, like, implicit in right speech, is, like, you should listen?
I think it should be. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, I hadn't really thought it. I mean, you know, we talk about, there's a sense of, you know, it's like how we, you know, give instruction, listen to a Tay show. You know, it's like right listening. You're listening with your whole body and mind. We've talked about that a lot in the Beyond Fear of Differences work. You know, to really hear someone and how important that is in terms of on all kinds of levels. So, yeah, it's a nice way of looking at that. Of what's happening on both sides, yeah. It's meeting that right speech, rightly. So I know I see some of your hands, and I'd like to just keep going. Maybe you can work your question into some of the next aspects. So slanderous speech. So Bhikkhu Bodhi quotes the Buddha, who says, avoid slanderous speech and abstain from it. What you have heard here, you do not repeat there, so as to cause dissension there. And what you have heard there, you do not repeat here, so as to cause dissension here. Thus, you unite those who are divided, and those that are united, you encourage. Concord gladdens you. You delight and rejoice in concord, and it is concord by which you spread your words. And so slanderous speech is spoken of as the desire to create division, to split people apart and to create distrust within, between people, between groups of people, and that alternately we should speak in such a way that promotes friendship and kindness and trust and harmony. The Pali word for slander means to break up fellowship. It just makes it pretty clear. And as I was thinking about this, I thought to really appreciate this, we have to understand and really know the importance of relation. You know, that if we don't understand that, then this doesn't matter, right? And again, I think, you know, we're seeing in such vivid display a lack of understanding and care, a profound lack of care for relation. And it's in Buddha, in the teachings, slander is spoken of as a very serious transgression because it combines ill will, the desire to actually do harm, plus a premeditated intention. And so karmically, it's, you know, sort of like a double hitter, you know, that it's bringing forth a couple of different elements which are them, each in and of themselves creating negative karma, and it's making this, and it's making them more powerful in a negative way. And so this is where loving kindness practices and developing empathy, sympathy, you know, all these different ways we have of feeling a connection, knowing a connection, but knowing at a deep level. You know, not just an idea, but so that in the same way that when we turn against ourselves, that should hurt. Right? If we don't feel the hurt of that, then it's because there's something in the way. Because it does hurt. And when we turn against others, if we don't feel the hurt of that, then there's something in the way that's preventing us from dealing with that, because it's there. The feeling is there. We're just not able to feel it because it's blocked.
I think we do feel it. We just don't. I mean, in my experience, I do feel it. I just think it's something else.
Well, that could be. So slanderous speech, too. To speak ill towards or against somebody. And so if you think of this, you know, relating these to the precepts, you could speak of speaking of others' errors and faults, you know, as sort of speaking injuriously. Elevating the self and blaming others could also be a different way of slandering, a way of slandering. So any thoughts on this? Kyoko?
I was thinking before about how the framework was feeling kind of like unilateral in a way of like, you know, it's me having right speech, it's me having slanderous speech. And I was thinking like, oh, there's like, where's the relational part? You know, as I try to become a more related person and myself, and I see that, you know, the ways we're doing that in community. And then I was thinking about the precepts and specifically the Vinaya, like how that was such a beautiful related way of being. And that maybe some of that got lost kind of in the transfer to a different culture. You know, because the story is that they would like come together and meet and like say out loud, this is what I did. Yeah. And there'd be like this contact, you know. Because right. I was thinking like there's not like a right checking it out with each other. You know, like there's like right speech in terms of like, I do this thing.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just something I give so much attention to these days is how do I do that with others in a way that is, you know, honest to myself and healing. And I wonder, do you think there's any places where right speech is kind of brought out in that way?
Well, I think it happens a lot in face-to-face. I mean, it happens as much as it happens. I don't know how much more it could happen, but it happens as much as it happens. And it happens, you know, between various of us at different moments when we are, you know, speaking truthfully or apologizing or, you know, I've thought often about, and I've never done it, so I'm speaking as an outsider, but of the function of confession, you know, of going into someone who represents, you know, sort of a intermediary with the ultimate, and to speak, you know, to bring forth what we have done, which has not been true. And the power of that, you know, if it's really sincere and if it's met well, I assume. While Doksan and Daisan is not confession, that there is that element, you know, of your sitting in the presence of somebody that hopefully there is mutual respect and a relationship. And that where that person does, in a sense, represent, is standing, you know, in the seat of the Dharma, right? So that's really what we're facing, right? And in that way, we're facing ourselves. And so that there are, I think that, because I think that's just a very ancient sort of primordial thing about human beings, you know, is that we need to, that often it's not enough just to hold ourselves accountable to ourselves, but sometimes we need to do that to others, even if it's really just about ourselves, not even necessarily what I have done to somebody else, but just that when we speak that out loud, it's got a different kind of power, right? And I think part of that is we're hearing ourselves say those words and saying it, being witnessed. But there's something very ancient about that, right? That's very human about that. You just think of all the ways in which that happens. I mean, you're a therapist, a counselor, you know, in bereavement. You know, people just, like, there's something, there's a magic that happens. Yeah. You have a mic?
It's from our reading. It's on the last page of Right Speech, and it's from a sutra. And in the middle of it, it says, truth is immortal speech. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could...
Is it immortal speech?
Immortal, mm-hmm. yeah, like undying. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could talk about that, and especially in light of what you were saying earlier and Bhikkhu Bodhi's looking at language and how through the Lankavatara mm-hmm. get to a what mm-hmm. seems to be a relatively non-dualistic mm-hmm. perspective on things. And so in that timeless space of manifesting truth,
yeah.
how do we...
Well, I think if we think of speech as not just... you know, vocalizing sounds, but expression. You know, that truth is unborn and undying expression, true expression, and so, which we're doing in every moment. We do it by how we sit, by how we walk, by how we lift up a cup, by how we close the door, by how we touch each other, you know, physically and in other ways. So how we manifest, you know, that I used to talk about combusting our lives. Well, we're always combusting. We're always here, right? We're here. And we're, in a sense, each of us is on display, right, to the world, and we're displaying our mind. And so in that way, and so a message is being sent, right, and being received. Can you pass that back?
There you go. I'm curious about language informing our just daily, mm-hmm. what is it? It's probably not minutia, something like that. But just the words you and I, mm-hmm. like I'm curious if that is a hindrance or if it's just about a clear understanding of what that means.
Yeah, it's both. I mean, I think it's a hindrance in the sense that we get duped by those words and take them as referring to something, you know, self-existing and separate. But we need those words, right? We have to use them. And so the Buddha said, and we speak of just, we use these words by convention. So recognizing they're a convention that we're using, they don't have any absolute truth or meaning. Right, they mean what we want them to mean, and they have the power in a sense that we give them. But we can also mean socially, and that's how words can have great healing power. But they can also become weapons. And so you look at how certain groups have taken words that have been historically used as weapons, and they take them and reclaim those words, right? Which only that group can do. Nobody else can do that, and it's very interesting. You know, how it's an attempt to shift the karma of that word from something that is hateful, you know, and intended, it is slanderous and harsh and so on, and false, and try and turn it into something positive. Very interesting how that is, yeah. So let's look at Tom.
You were talking about confessional. Recently, I've been practicing when I've messed up, trying to just say that mm-hmm. and let some of the people close to me know that I'm going to do it in case mm-hmm. it feels weird. So I just have to be with it when I say it. And no context, just say it.
Yeah.
And it's hard, but it feels important to be in that feeling between the person when it's possible to do that. And then the other thing that's hard is, because you're also talking about addiction, if I have a thing, like I have an addictive thing I have to watch with YouTube, and if I say out loud to a friend or my girlfriend what happened with it or my intention for later to help, it's so different. Mm-hmm. It feels like, I don't know if addiction depends on secrecy, but there's something mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. shifts yeah. when it's said out loud.
Yeah, and I think yeah. both of those are related. I've learned a lot from people who in different moments will say something, just like what you said, just say something, what's going on for them in a way that's so simple, but they say it. You know, like, I'm really struggling now. Or I don't know what I feel. You know, what do you feel? I don't know what I feel. And as I remember, it's like, oh, you can say that, right? Like, that's, you know, you don't have to wait until you know what you feel to speak. You can just say, I don't know what I feel. And how powerful that is, because it also, in terms of relation, is bringing the person closer, because it's like, oh, now I know, right? And that's honest. Like, that's a perfectly honest truth. So the next is harsh speech. And so here too, and Bhikkhu Bodhi, quoting the Buddha, says, to avoid harsh language and abstain from it is abstain from harsh speech. Speak words that are gentle, soothing to the ear, loving, words that go to the heart, that are courteous, friendly, and agreeable. And he goes on to talk about different kinds of harsh speech. And he says harsh speech is characterized by being grounded in anger and intended to cause harm or pain. And so he talks about abusive speech as being intended to scold or revile and to reprove someone with angry words. It's not just offering helpful criticism. Insulting speech is to hurt by seizing upon somebody's perceived characteristic and making that a way to hurt them. And sarcastic speech, which is like not straight ahead and is often veiled, veiling is sort of concealing a indirect jab. And that the other side of, or the antidote to harsh speech is patience, and to be able to tolerate criticism from others when we're being held accountable or being blamed, which from a Buddhist perspective also means unjustly. And it doesn't mean to just not respond, but it means to be able to hear that within, to actually hear it, right? Because if we're just defensive, then we're not hearing it. We're just defending. And so to be able to actually receive that and just let it, hear it, but and let it pass through so we don't seize on it, right? Which is when we become defensive, but we're also not just ignoring it. And to be able to just see and accept other people's shortcomings, so to not speak of others' errors and faults, is to see them, right? It's not to be blind, but it's not to enjoy those errors and faults, right? That we take no delight. It's like the immeasurable of gladness, that rather than enjoying seeing other people struggle or have bad luck or have some, you know, fault, that we actually enjoy people's well-being and their good luck and their accomplishments and their positive traits, and that we can delight in that and have understanding and acceptance and empathy when we see somebody who is struggling. So both harsh speech and slander speech are being used to hurt, to injure, in slightly different ways.
Like, I guess there's a part of me that's just like, this is, it's probably not what you mean, but I'm just curious, because, you know, I don't know, because there's sort of like the, like, enjoying people's errors and faults, like, kind of in a mean-spirited way, mm-hmm. of like, oh, haha, like, you know, you screwed up, but then there's also the kind of, like, loving enjoyment of other people's like foibles, mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily that you're like, oh, I don't want to like help you, like, you know, in whatever way you can. It's just sort of like, oh, that's kind of what makes that person sometimes. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that it's okay to like have those feelings, but, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, you don't need my permission.
Well, of course I don't, but, yeah. You know, sometimes it's like...
Yes. I mean, you said it, that one is divisive, one is, you know, creating separation and causing harm, and the other brings you closer, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's you know, just feeling the humanity of the person or, you know, it allowing you to accept your own humanity, your own foibles, whether it's actually something that you can really appreciate about that person. You know, I think one of the things about being in a Sangha is seeing, you know, living in the midst of everyone who's striving, you know, in this path, and each in our own way and at our own place, and struggling at different times, and striving within that, you know, in a well-meaning way, and that all of that together is so incredibly beautiful. You know, I've said it before that, you know, it happens all the time, but particularly during Sesshin, in a way, people become more and more beautiful, you know, because a lot of the, you know, things just drop away, and that allowing ourselves to be ourselves in that vulnerability, but also in it simultaneously being empowered, you know, so it's not just becoming complacent with those aspects of ourselves, but it's genuine acceptance, and it's also, you know, busting out. And so, and there's, it's just something immeasurably, to me, inspiring about that. And that is to me, is the sort of epitome of the wonder of a human being. And what makes us so gorgeous as beings, you know.
I was wondering if sarcasm is kind of can be viewed in the same way, whereas sometimes it is divisive and can be hurtful, but other times it's playful and, you know, like a joke at times. Yeah. I was surprised to see that in the chapter.
Well, so think of it again in terms of, you know, so again, if you think of this in terms of not just fixed rules, but in terms of intention, time and place, person, your position with that person, so to, you know, have a friendly banter. Now sometimes that does have veiled barbs, you know, and sometimes it's loving, you know. And so it's just, it's for us, it's for you to know, you know, that in that is this really, is it coming from a caring place, or is it a sort of a passive way or a humorous way of actually, you know, trying to dig into somebody. You know, it's interesting. I remember years ago when I was living, I was in my teens, I was living on a farm in North Georgia with an old family that had been, you know, farmers forever. And I was making a joke with Miss Kinney, and it was kind of sarcastic. And she was like, "What?" And I said it again, and she said, "What?" And she was hearing it literally. And I realized, oh, shit, you know, it's like, how do I back myself out of this? Because now she wanted to understand what I was saying. But it was absurd to explain it because it was kind of a sarcastic joke. And it was like, how do I get out of this? But it was very interesting because I thought, I mean, she was a very incredible person and very wise in many ways, not what most of us would think of as worldly. You know, and so I was thinking of different kinds of humor. I mean, humor itself is such an incredible thing. Like, what is it? You know? What is that? But then sarcastic humor. You know, there's so many complexities within humor. And that kind of humor is like, I thought, I don't think she knows this. And I thought, I think that may be a good thing, you know. I felt kind of jaded, you know, in that moment. So, and the last and favorite, idle, frivolous speech. So here, this is speech that has no benefit. Right, it's not serving, but that I don't think we should take that to mean that it's neutral. In other words, it has no positive benefit. It doesn't mean it doesn't have consequence. But it, no benefit in the sense that it's not serving the speaker, it's not serving the hearers. It's pointless. It's just taking up space. It's lacking purpose or depth. It's said that it only stirs inner entanglements and increases them. It distracts us from what's important. And so I think, again, Mokado was talking about tropes and just the sort of the ubiquity and the ferocity of idle speech. Sometimes it's spoken of as gossip. And so, you know, often the concern with this is that all of those many casual conversations that we have with each other. It is true that the Buddha would often say, speak about the Dharma or don't speak at all. He was also, when he said that, he was speaking to ordained monastics. Which would mean that they were not always only speaking about the Dharma and just being silent. But, you know, the way I think of this is that there are, and I've said this, is that there are many ways in which casual conversation, it does have benefit. It is benefiting self and others, sort of what Tyler was talking about. Sometimes just to learn how to come forward and speak, you know, I mean, some of you and a lot of residents have talked about how hard it is with people come in for retreats and just that dining room, you know, and that meal table and sitting down with people and how, you know, the struggle that many people have with how do you just engage in conversation. And so, you know, simple, casual conversation can be very powerful, just in and of itself as a way of just making contact. And, you know, as opposed to sitting down and, you know, saying, so let's talk about the Four Noble Truths to somebody who's just walked in the door. I would say that is not yet appropriate. It's also something that comes up in the Eight Awarenesses. And here it's spoken of as idle speech. And it's described as having realization and being free from discrimination is what is called avoiding idle talk. So when we understand what is true, to totally know the true form of all things is the same as being without idle talk. So again, this brings us to that sense of being in alignment, that when we speak in a way that has no benefit, in a sense that can only come from not understanding or being distant from what is true. The Buddha says he's talking to monks, when you monks engage in various kinds of idle talk, your minds become disturbed. Although you have left home to become monks, you're still not liberated. Therefore, you should quickly abandon mind-disturbing idle talk. If you would like to attain the joy of enlightenment, you must first simply let go of the affliction of idle talk. So what about that? I mean, what's the other side of that? What's the other side of language that is without benefit? And how could you speak of that?
Well, I'm sorry. I think I kind of jumped on a different cue. Sure. But just hearing about this, I was thinking about arrogance and how... You know, speaking truthfully or not, you know, speaking idly. Seems like on the side of virtue, supposedly virtue, taken in a simplistic way, there can be a lot of troubling things, you know. I find that's often in an asserting, in a kind of, you know, cutting way, what is truth, you know. And it might be that, you know, very much believe this to be so, mm-hmm. But there is a distinct aggression in that kind of righteousness.
Yeah. And so how is that not right speech? What makes that? Like, what's going on that makes that into something else?
Well, it kind of reminds me of the quote
where the meaning and reality were exchanged, mm-hmm. and the sort of elaboration of a meaning there, which was sort of the Bodhisattva's path, which seems like a major like caveat.
Yeah. So the Buddha in that passage was talking about, you know, to understand the meaning or the real nature of things, you go to you go alone to a place of solitude and you revolutionize the mind. In this passage I just read, you know, he's equating basically that in understanding the real nature of things, that is then not having any idle talk because it's no longer coming from grasping or deluded or a sense of separation. So in terms of the practice of that, right, you can just think of at every step along the way as we, you know, move towards or, you know, have moments of understanding or insight, and that every practice that we're doing that is rather than creating, promoting a sense of separation, is encouraging a sense of coming together or unity, that is rather than promoting a sense of myself, you know, or arrogance or righteousness, is cultivating humility, right, or selflessness. And so that's what we're actually trying to do every day. That is practicing in alignment, in accord with the way. Is it when we do that, right, in our thoughts, words, and actions, in our relationships with each other, in the work that we do? You know, that's why work practice is about so much more than getting done. It's what is my, how do I live in accord? How do I have integrity as a human being, as a person, in every moment, right? So what is it not to have integrity, right? What is it not to be true to myself? So first there has to be a sense of what am I aligning myself with, right? So to be wholehearted, to care, to be meticulous, to do a good job, to take responsibility when I mess up, all of those, you know, basic kind of, you know, things that are sort of part of every moral system. But they're understood here in a very, very deep way because it's creating karma, which really means it's consciousness, it's mind, right? It's either strengthening that sense of self and all of the afflictions that arise out of that, or it's diminishing those. And so when we understand that, you know, that whole sense of you know, this is really important and this is not really important. I'm going to really be wholehearted here, but here I'm going to, you know, just throw it all away. You know, I need to be accountable here, but I can get away with that. You know, is really still based in that sense that, you know, I'm a compartment. I'm like a building with different floors and rooms, and I could lock certain rooms and you can't get into them, right? I've got stuff in there, but you can't get to it. Or I can lock certain parts of myself in those rooms and they can't get out. And that just ain't so. It ain't necessarily so.
I've been wondering if there's an element in this of not being withholding in our speech and in true relating with each other. It seems like a lot of the time we tend to sort of orbit in our own worlds and then only have those sort of simpler, more surface conversations and not mm-hmm. really display more of our minds to mm-hmm. each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so there again, you know, that precept speaks to, you know, what we might offer that would be a benefit, would help. And so, yeah, in terms of like, you know, in a place like this where there's a lot of sharing of ourselves with each other and you know, how that can be a way of bringing us closer or actually putting ourselves further apart. How it can be a way of really connecting with another person, or it can be a way of forgetting that that person is there, right? And it's just my story. And so how do we gauge, how do we know that as we're finding our way? Well, one, I think, is comes back to being aware of what we're actually experiencing and where it's coming from. And where, you know, how quickly something that is sort of you know, one action, one conversation can be moving along in a nice way, and then suddenly it just starts to shift and become something else. And also to be aware of what's happening on the other side, you know, where we see that the other person, we're losing them, right? Or they're starting to glaze over, or they're, you know, they're not listening, right? Or they're trying to speak, but we won't let them. So, and so in that way, Sangha just becomes a everyday speech fest, right? And at the same time, and that's why I think it's so important that the silence, I think part of how we're learning about speech is by silence. You know, that it's in our silence is sort of, you know, how part of how we learn about how to be in relationship is within solitude. You know, and that takes different forms. Sometimes it's physical solitude, sometimes it's just not relating to each other verbally. And learning that we're still in relationship, right? When somebody's up on the mountain doing hermitage, they're still in relationship. We are in relationship to them. They don't cease to exist. And they're just different ways, and we can get caught in just very narrow modes of relationship, and or even expressions of compassion. You know, how compassion can be shown, you know, it can take many, many different forms. Sometimes that are very obvious, and sometimes that are much more subtle. And speech is very much about that. Okay. So I think when we come back again, we'll be in our winter training period. Yeah. So, and that will be right action. So that might even be the week after. It's probably not the week of Thanksgiving. The week after. Anyway. We'll check the calendar. We'll all check the calendar. Okay, so thank you, everybody. Hoki, would you? Four bows.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JIZOPROJECT.